Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 51. My name is Karen. Your name is?
Kristen.
Hi, everybody.
What's up?
We made it to the other side of 50.
Yes, we did.
Now we're back on the climb up.
That's right.
To 100.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm excited.
We'll probably get to 100 before we see an episode of this show.
Yeah, I mean, that's... No, I was actually... What was I doing? I was doing our schedule the other day, and I saw that we're going to finish this book series, I think, the first week. Yeah, we get to the last chapter the first week of January 2023. So we're actually going to be the rest of the year talking about The Last Olympian. And I was like, oh, wow. And then it'll just be like the rest, yeah. Like what comes next and doing all of that. So that'll be interesting. So, yeah, I'm excited, but also I feel like, wow, we have so much to do still.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing when you're a podcast. You don't want to run out of content.
No. Ideas are not always easy.
Yeah.
Although we have lots. Trust me.
We have lots, but they don't always fit into the right weeks. Like, we have to, like, spread things out, and that's where it becomes a little hard.
And then we come up with ideas, and we're like, but we should save that. Like,
yeah.
That should either come after the show starts, or
yeah.
We should save that for once we've read all of this series, or maybe all of that series.
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be a while. Well, we can save that for that. Like, it's like, ah. You come up with ideas, you write them down, and then it's like, well, wait, we can't use that yet.
Yeah.
Gotta come up with something for today!
But if you have ideas, and you would like to share them with us and give us some inspiration, you can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. How'd you like that transition?
That was fantastic.
It was flawless.
Primo.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to get into news and updates, and we actually have some exciting things to talk about today, so...
I know. I saw one of them.
Yeah, I'm very ready for this. Before we get to that, though, we have a few other things ahead of it. So, the first thing is You Only Live Once, David Bravo by Mark Ashiro is out now. That's very exciting. Mark Ashiro is going to be very relevant to a piece of news a little bit later in the podcast.
Possibly,
so
maybe.
Just had to throw that out there first. Reed Riordan also did an article about the five things we loved about the teaser trailer, which I thought was really nice that they put up, just because, like, I like that they're talking about the show and stuff like that, because up until this point, has Reed Riordan done any show-related articles at all?
I mean, not specifically that I can remember.
Because most of them are from the books and about Rick Riordan Presents, so...
Yeah, maybe there was one, but I don't remember... seeing anything.
Yeah.
So that is fun.
I think, you know, most of the things that they seem to be excited about, we've talked about a lot on the podcast.
Yes.
So if you, you know, are listening to us for the first time, you liked this article, go back to our teaser trailer article. We go very in-depth on the 52 seconds that was that teaser trailer, so hopefully you guys enjoy that. So this one is a little off topic, but like there's still some relevancy here. So in case you guys aren't aware, Gotham Group is the production company behind adapting Percy Jackson and the Olympians for Disney Plus. And okay, I'm just gonna pause here and say that they are mowing the lawn and weed whacking outside the window right now. And there's nothing we can do about it, so I'm very sorry if you can hear that and it's annoying. It's probably going to be a low background noise for a while. We need to record this podcast right now, so it's not going to change.
Wow, are they getting closer?
Yeah, they're getting louder.
Turning up the volume just to be jerk
like,
faces.
Oh, they're recording a podcast. Put it on hyperspeed.
Right. How loud can we get this engine?
Yeah.
Jeez. All right.
Anyway, yeah. So Gotham Group is producing Percy Jackson and the Olympians. They are now also adapting The Ring and the Crown by Melissa De La Cruz for Disney+. This is a YA fantasy series. I think she said that she was inspired by... It wasn't War and Peace, was it? It was. Okay, so she was inspired by her favorite book of all time, Tolstoy's War and Peace, which... That's your favorite book of all time?
Right,
not judging you.
No.
I'm not judging you, but, like, that's a little intense.
That's very good for you.
As well as my favorite mythology of all time, the Arthurian legends. And it's about a princess and the daughter of Merlin, and it's got a lot of, like, political intrigue and stuff like that. I feel like it kind of reminds me a little bit of Shadow and Bone. Like, not quite the same world or anything like that, but I feel like this high fantasy YA adaptation with a lot of characters and the political stuff and magic. And this is coming to Disney Plus. That's on Netflix. So
there have been a lot of the blank and the blank when it comes to fantasy novels in the last like 5 to 10 years. Like, I feel like there are so many. You can insert one random nature thing with one magical, mythical word, and like you've got a title.
Yeah.
There are so many of them. So when I first saw this, I was like, wait, do I know about this one?
I
hadn't heard of this one until just now, but Melissa De La Cruz has been writing for Disney for a long time.
Yeah.
She's done everything from the Descendants books to, like, that Alex and Eliza book from a while back. Like, she's been writing for them for a long time. So I'm glad that she gets this opportunity because she does do a lot of work.
And she has a lot of fans. And I feel like, you know, this is definitely... I like that this is a YA adaptation that they're doing. I feel like Disney, not to, like, get, you know, on my high horse over here on my little pedestal, but Disney has the opportunity right now to... do what Netflix tried to do and failed spectacularly, which was make very good, high-quality adaptations and just, like, live on that a little bit, because Netflix had too many hands in the cookie jar, like, too many irons in the fire. That's what I wanted to say.
Too many chefs in the kitchen.
Yeah. They tried to do too much with everything that they were doing, and the quality decreased.
Yeah.
Phenomenally.
I mean, they had some successes, and then it was like, as soon as they had a success, they tried to replicate it, and it just petered off.
Yeah.
I do think Disney has a unique position with this, too, because, like, we all love Disney, especially for the Marvel series that we've got, especially She-Hulk. If you're not watching She-Hulk, oh my gosh, it's so funny. It's so great. And then, like, you've got the Star Wars stuff with Mandalorian, but, like, all of that feels a little more adult. It's very, it's grounded in an adult world as opposed to one for youths. It's hard to say youths. I was trying to be funny. But, like, Percy Jackson is designed and planned for middle grade audience, but also for all these people who've been following the series for a million years, a.k.a. us that do not qualify as youths anymore.
But, I'm a youth. I can be a youth.
But they've got all these books that they've been putting out for so long and so much variety. They could do YA rom-coms. They can do stuff like this where it's a little more high fantasy. They can do mystery novels, and they've got all kinds of stuff under their publishing umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Disney could become the home for YA adaptations.
Yeah.
Just starting with the books they already own.
Yeah.
Like, Disney wouldn't have to reach out beyond the Disney publishing sphere to start. You've got all the Rick Riordan Presents books. You've got so many opportunities. So I really hope that the Percy show and this show here are just the beginning for Disney kind of tapping into their own resource full of gems. It's all rubies and emeralds as far as I'm concerned.
And so, like, sapphires.
Right, and sapphires. There's just so much that they can do, and I really hope that this is kind of the beginning.
And I think Disney has a lot more experience than Netflix did. They've been producing movies and shows for a very long time. Of course, Disney Plus is a little bit on the newer side for them in terms of, like, a streaming platform, but, like, they've been doing a fine job. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of fans. And I think that their brand name speaks to the YA audience and to kids too, but like, you know, kids and teens watching Disney, and of course adults too, but they really have a huge opportunity here, and that's why I wanted to mention this, not just because of the tie to Percy Jackson, but because I think that Disney Plus could become the home for a lot of things that you and I would like to watch, and a lot of things I think our listeners would like as well.
I mean, there's a little fantasy series that's not too sexy by Ms. Cora Carmack that I think would be a fabulous adaptation for Disney. I mean, they don't own it yet. It's like, it's Tor, so it's not, it's not Disney. But I'm just saying, if they wanted to look into it.
Have we mentioned that on this podcast at all yet?
I don't think so.
Wow.
I'm always looking out for my girl, Cora.
Yeah.
Trying to get her stuff adapted, because it would be so cool.
It would be.
I'm done.
I read the first book. It was very good. It's very visual.
We're still waiting on book three. Poor Cora. She'll get it done. Trust me. She wants to get it done, but she's had some health problems.
This is Roar by
Cora Carmack. The second book is Rage. They are. I want to say it's like NA. It's like it's not. It's a little older than YA, but it's not quite like an adult romance where there's a ton of like graphic stuff going on. It's a little older than YA. So like if you're if you've got a kid that's 16, 17, 18, they probably could read this book with no problem. I mean, as far as like content wise. And I've only read the first two because they're what's out, but they're fantastic and I love them. So, you know, anyway, I'm going to stop talking. This is not a Cora Carmack podcast.
No, it's not. Speaking of a book we're excited about, though, we now have a title for the Solangelo book.
We timed our recording perfectly.
We did. And you know what? I did not... this never occurred to me as a title, but, like, it feels really fitting now.
Yeah.
So it's called The Sun and the Star, a Nico D'Angelo Adventure. I really love that.
It's very...
yeah.
Wonderful.
And I want to read you Mark Ishiro's tweets about this. And so I saw somebody grab a screenshot from the Read Riordan website with this title along the bottom, because I think they were like adding a page for it and then just didn't make like the link at the bottom of whatever page they were on, like the series pages or something like that, private or whatever. So I think it like kind of got leaked on accident. Not 100% sure about that. It's just like the order of which I saw things.
Yeah.
But then Mark came out last night, actually, to talk about it, and they say, I know many of you have been waiting patiently for news, so I am happy to confirm a small piece of it for you. The upcoming Solangelo novel, co-written between Rick Riordan and myself, is indeed titled The Sun and the Star, a Nico D'Angelo Adventure. I will tell you more about the title when the time is right, and the best part is that time, well, it is coming up soon. Look for more news on The Sun and the Star next week. So... that is very good for us.
Not long to wait.
Yeah, very excited about that. And if you're like, why that title? I'm curious. Mark does seem to imply that it is a reference to Bob saying, tell the sun and the stars hello for me, which actually makes sense because I went back to... episode 5, where we talked about the Solangelo book announcement and pulled some of the stuff that we kind of already knew would lead into this novel. So the last time we saw Nico D'Angelo was in The Tower of Nero, the last Trials of Apollo book. Nico had been hearing a voice calling out from Tartarus asking for help, and he thinks it's Bob. So the sun and the star makes sense.
Yeah.
Nico says, I feel like I should look for him, see if I can figure out what happened. He might need my help. I don't like it when people are overlooked. And Hades had forbidden anybody going to visit Tartarus, but Nico has the troglodytes who will help. And Rachel Elizabeth Dare gives Nico and Will a prophecy. Apollo didn't hear it, therefore we didn't hear it. But Will admits that it doesn't sound good because it's a prophecy. It's not supposed to sound good.
It never does, yeah.
So the fact that the title is The Sun and the Star very much makes sense for me.
I kind of wonder if maybe they don't, like, maybe Will makes some dumb joke and is like, well, you know, I'm the sun.
Yeah.
And Nico's like, well, then I guess I'm the star. Yeah. And, like, I can see that being, like, a theme kind mm-hmm. of running through the whole thing then.
Yeah.
So I really hope.
Yeah, I think the sun also, it could be, like, you know, a double entendre kind of thing or, like, two references. I think it makes sense that Will would be the sun. I'm curious to see... Because it's not the stars, it's the star,
right.
implying it's a reference to one person or one entity or something, so I'm very curious about this. I also want to know if we're going to see Apollo again, because he's gone through his literal trials and has become Apollo once more. Of course, he's Will's father, so
yeah.
he could possibly show up in the book. We'll see. Come on, man!
You got so far away, I thought we were done.
Yeah, it's like you doing a second lap. What's going on?
Give a girl a break. It's edged, okay? Things are fixed. It looks nice. Just, you're done with the weed whacking.
You know, aw, they probably destroyed all the honey mushrooms in
probably.
Our yard.
They'll come back.
I know.
They usually do.
I know. I love them so much. Okay, anyway. So, yeah. I'm feeling pretty good about this. I'm glad that we're getting more news next week. Maybe we'll get an official synopsis. We could be getting a cover. Sometimes they do a cover like a year out, so...
Especially if they had ideas throughout the book what they wanted, mm-hmm. like while they were writing it, if they had ideas of what they liked.
Yeah,
wanted
if they
on the
had
cover.
Like scenes and imagery in their head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's possible. It's definitely possible.
I'll be curious who does the cover as well, because at this point, like, I mean, I would love if John Rocco did it, but
yeah.
I kind of feel like they don't need to do that, because other people have taken on the covers for the series in updated versions, and even though this is in the Camp Half-Blood Chronicles series, because Rick is co-writing it with Mark... I kind of feel like it would be cool to have bring in somebody else to like make the cover for it, but
yeah, definitely. I'd definitely be open to that too.
Yeah,
however they think is
yes,
best.
I'll be happy with whatever
right.
they want to give us.
Just as long as it's amazing.
Yeah,
we're not hard to please.
Yeah, exactly. So very cool, very excited. Obviously, next week we will let you know what they tell us.
Mm-hmm.
We'll keep you guys updated. I want to move into our discussion for this week. We are talking about our monster guide for Echidna and Chimera, and this is a mother spawn duo here that we wanted to kind of condense into one episode because it made more sense to pair them together.
They're not the most famous of Greek monsters,
yeah.
so we figured there wouldn't be a ton of information about them, but they kind of, like, because they're both smaller, not as used, but definitely used in the Percy Jackson universe, it would be worth it to kind of just pair them together.
Yeah, and we were kind of right, because when I was going through Percy Jackson's Greek gods and Greek heroes, Echidna didn't really have a whole lot in there. Basically, she's the mother of the Chimera, and then the Chimera has myths and heroes related to what that creature got up to. So
yeah.
I want to start off first in Greek mythology and start by saying Echidna was married to Typhus, aka Typhon. I always forget that these are the same because they're spelled very differently, but they are the same monster. So the Typhon that's marching its way across the Midwest in the Last Olympian right now is the Typhon that we're talking about here.
Now, just... maybe I'm crazy. Do we know what Echidna looks like?
I will get to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because okay. my brain is trying to, like, visualize this, and I'm like, okay, wait. But I don't remember. Okay, never mind. Just keep going.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly where we get to it, but I remember writing about it. So
okay.
I will let you know.
<It's> okay.
Okay, so Typhon is the son of Mother Earth and Tartarus. And in some myths, these were also Echidna's parents, so they are technically siblings. Which in Greek mythology is very normal.
Yeah.
But also, Tartarus being your father... not great.
No.
And they obviously had a lot of horrible children together. Percy says almost every monster you can think of was a child of these two creatures. So, yeah, they spawned a lot of horrible children. And in this section of the book, he does specifically reference both the Hydra and the Sphinx. So, I also find it very interesting that we don't really know Echidna. Like, we're not super familiar with her. But the Hydra, the Sphinx. Like,
right.
Those are very iconic monsters. So she was... And even the Chimera in a little bit. I mean, I think it's becoming more common.
It's been used more in pop culture. Yeah. So I think, yeah, it's so, kind of coming out.
Poor Echidna. I don't really feel bad for her. But poor Echidna, who is always outshone by her children. Now, the Chimera, obviously one of her children, was part lion, part dragon, part goat. Which is a very interesting combination.
Mm-hmm.
Percy says it was the size of a woolly mammoth. Its head and forearms were that of a lion. Its back half was scaly and reptilian, with dragon legs and a snaky tail with a rattlesnake tip. And, this is the most interesting part, a goat head that stuck up from the middle of its back like a periscope, turning 360 degrees and spewing fire. He described it as a barnyard animal of mass destruction. When I was picturing, like, part lion, part dragon, part goat, I figured, like, okay, so maybe it was, like, a lion head, because that's kind of scary, lion front paws or whatever, and maybe, like, a dragon tail and a goat body or something like that. Like, I was trying to split it up into thirds, not this weird, like, lion-dragon hybrid with a goat head periscope on its back.
Yeah, I was thinking more like lion-shaped body, scales of a dragon, okay, with this dragon tail, and then, like, goat hooves and, like...
And, like, horns or something. Yeah.
So, like, that's kind of what my brain pictures when you think of combining those three animals. Not... Half lion, half dragon, added goat.
Yeah.
Like.
It's just, I forgot to add the goat. Just sprinkle it on top. It'll be fine.
They have stretchy necks anyway, so just have it, like, pop out of its back. Look around, see what's going on. So,
it also breathes fire. And, like.
And the lion wasn't going to be breathing fire. Yeah. So they were like, let's just give it to the goat. It's half dragon.
That makes sense.
It's half dragon. We can, yeah.
It's fine.
Just give it to the goat.
So, King Amisodarus tried harnessing the Chimera for war, and it ended up destroying his kingdom, and then moved on to surrounding kingdoms.
That was pretty...
Yeah, I mean, nobody is surprised, except for maybe King Amisodarus.
I mean, I guess if you're desperate and you gotta try it, you gotta try it, but that seems predictable to me.
Yeah. Now it's setting King Iobates' kingdom ablaze. That's hard to say in the plural.
King Iobates' kingdom.
Iobates'
I don't think you have to add the extra S, but if you need to, that's fine.
Okay.
We're not correcting grammar over here.
And now it's setting the kingdom of King Iobates ablaze.
There you go. Beautiful.
Iobates hires Bellerophon, who is the son of Poseidon, to kill it. And this was really interesting to me. So this entire chapter was actually about Bellerophon, and... The Chimera was only one part of it, so I didn't get a lot of, like, background information on where Bellerophon came from, but I did skip back just to make sure that, like, Poseidon was his father, and surprisingly, his mother was one of the few who volunteered to sleep with the god. So, like, this wasn't, you know, a bad situation where the gods...
This was consensual!
Not taking advantage of her and stuff like that, so I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know if Bellerophon, like, shows up at all in the series or is mentioned a whole lot or anything like that, but considering there's an entire chapter in this book on him, I would love to revisit him someday because he seems like an interesting hero. He apparently was, like, bad at everything and people are always telling him not to do stuff, and then he wasn't very coordinated, and as a hero, you kind of want good hand-eye coordination.
So, when Rick gets tired of writing about modern-day heroes, he can go back and write a Bellerophon series and give us the many adventures of Bellerophon. just do, like, an adaptation, but make it YA, make it middle grade, make it fun. Yeah. I think he could
do. Who doesn't love a clumsy hero?
Right!
Also, he was friends with Pegasus, so he brought him along for the ride on this adventure. So, Bellerophon goes after the Chimera, and he's like, oh wow, this thing is actually really scary. How am I going to kill it? He ends up defeating him by impaling a piece of soft lead on the tip of his spear and then shoving it down the goat's throat so that it would melt and go into its lungs and suffocate it. Ugh. Yeah. It's not a good way to die.
No.
You know, it's the chimera. I'm not that mad about it. Right. But it still sounds awful.
Yeah.
So then Bellerophon cut off the goat's head and headed back to King Iobates to collect his reward. And that is basically the end of the chimera.
If that killed the goat part, why would that kill the whole thing?
Maybe the lion head and the goat head. Doesn't do the breathing? Yeah, or it's like a network of lungs. It has like giant lungs or shared lungs. And so one kills one to kill the other.
I mean, it makes sense. My brain just thinks
of. Are you really questioning the anatomy of this lion, dragon, goat hybrid?
My brain is just thinking, if the goat is suffocated, why does that mean the lion that has a mouth can't breathe? Like, I was... But they're one creature, Kristen, so they share organs. Yeah. We're gonna just keep moving. Sorry, my bad. Trying to bring logic and, you know...
Don't question the science, Kristen. We've learned this years ago.
Should know better.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're jumping into Percy Jackson, and there's actually some really cool things to talk about here now that we have a background with these creatures in mythology. So I want to start off with Echidna and Percy Jackson. According to the wiki, which is where I pulled all this information, some of Echidna's children include Cerberus, the Nebian lion, the Colchian dragon, the manticore, Orthus, Ladon, who was the one who killed Zoe, right? Wasn't that the dragon guarding the tree that killed Zoe? So, like, a lot of these creatures, very famous. We've already seen a lot of them. The manticore we saw recently, the Nebian lion, all of them. So
yeah.
Thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So they're in the St. Louis Arch. That's where he comes upon Echidna and her child.
Mm-hmm.
So as a person, Echidna is depicted as a plus-sized woman in a denim dress with a fearsome chihuahua, which is the chimera, named Sunny? Question mark. I mean, she calls him Sunny, which, like, implies that it's her son.
Right. So she might have just been.
Right. Yeah. But we kind of go by its name is Sunny. She has a reptilian tongue and slitted eyes, despite the fact that she looks like a person. Now, I just wanted to, like, pause here for a second and say, I'll be interested to see how they depict her in the show. Because it's not quite as good these days to have your villains be fat and ugly. And I feel like, you know, this is one of the things that people talk about in Rick's earlier books, that they're like, some questionable choices. Like, we didn't really like that depiction. I'm curious if she will look like that in the television show or if they're going to change it.
It's possible, yeah.
Do you have any opinions on that?
I mean, when it comes to things like this, I always just assume that some monsters are going to be big when they're in human form because there's a lot of them. Like, Echidna is not a small monster. So in order to fit into a human form, they're going to use a plus-size figure. So, like, for me, it doesn't really have any connotation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. But I understand some people have, you know, that kind of hits close to home and it feels just icky. And they would prefer that not be a, you know, genre norm, basically. Mm-hmm. And I totally get that. So, if they change it, absolutely. But for me, it's more of like, I go to the logical thing. Like, well, it's a big monster.
Yeah.
They need a big body to kind of hide in.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the form they take. Like, for me, that's kind of where it sits. But I definitely understand.
Although that clearly doesn't translate to the chimera, who was a chihuahua, so.
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, it just depends on the magic, and it depends on, but my brain logically just kind of goes to that, and then it's like, well, then there's a chimera.
Yeah.
It's huge, but is also a chihuahua.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see what direction they go in for that. I feel like I've land pretty close to you with that opinion. So her true form is she has a human head, a snake-like body, a forked tongue and fangs, reptilian eyes, and bright green scaly skin.
Legs? No legs. Just no legs? Snaky.
Snaky body, human
so
head.
So she's Jafar with a human head.
Was Jafar?
When he's a big snake.
Oh.
You'll see how snake-like I can be. He becomes like a giant, like, almost purple snake.
Okay.
But he has, like, it's not a human head, but he's a very humanistic, like, dragon, snake dragon head.
Okay.
So, like, right. I'm thinking human head on this snake body.
Yeah. Oh. I feel like, so there's, like, an image in my head of a woman with a snake body and arms in some piece of media.
Hmm.
And I can't quite put my finger on it. So if anybody knows if there was any movie or anything like that with a creature like that, let me know. Because it would be nice to be able to place it.
Now my brain wants to find the answer. Where's the answer?
Okay, I'm going to keep going with some fun facts.
Yes.
You keep looking. So sometimes Camp and Echidna are thought to be the same monster, which I thought was pretty interesting. These are all from the Wikipedia. I did not fact check. I'm sorry. I just assumed the Wikipedia is correct. Although the Wikipedia did lead me wrong last week when I thought that one book came out in 2023, Moko Magic, and it actually comes out in 2024.
That was probably more of a, it just didn't get updated recently.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Rather than it being wrong, it just wasn't most up to date.
But I still thought these were pretty interesting. So yeah, Camp and Echidna are thought to be the same sometimes. And Camp is described very similar to that now that I'm thinking about it. She has a snake-like body, so.
Yeah, so I can see why they kind of get mashed into one being.
The Sphinx is the only monster in the Percy Jackson series whose father might not be Typhon. It might be Orthus. And if you remember, Orthus is her son.
Yeah.
So that's great. And she and the Chimera, Echidna and the Chimera, are one of the few monsters not defeated and sent to Tartarus in the entire series, which I find very interesting.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Percy just jumps out the window.
Right.
So, and in The Lightning Thief, you'll remember that she alludes to Zeus letting her test Percy, probably because Zeus thought Percy was the Lightning Thief. But I thought that was very interesting that Zeus basically led Echidna to Percy and let her kind of go after him without really caring whether or not he was actually the Lightning Thief.
Thanks, Zeus.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to jump to the Chimera. The Chimera in the book is described as having the head of a lion, the body of a goat, blood-caked mane, a 10-foot-long diamondback snake-headed tail, has a venomous bite, and breathes fire. The venomous bite is from the snake tail. And I think also the snake tail breathes fire. And it wore a rhinestone dog collar both as a chihuahua and as a chimera. And Percy specifically says in the Greek Heroes book that monsters often change their appearance, and this is how he explains the difference between the chimera in the mythology way back when versus how he sees the chimera when he meets it.
I mean, honestly, that doesn't feel that unrealistic that, like, a chimera that is a magical creature in its own respect, like, from the start,
mm-hmm.
can change what portions of its being are reptilian or lion or, you know, like, as long as it's working in the goat, lion, dragon sphere,
yeah,
it can kind of morph a little bit how it uses those qualities. So, like, that makes total sense to me.
Yeah. And it was also a lot bigger back then than it is now. So that's, you know, another thing. But I feel like this does make sense and falls in line with what we've seen in the rest of the series, because we know the gods can change their appearance at will. And I think that it would only make sense that the monsters could as well. Maybe not to the extent that the gods can, but if it relies on people remembering them and, you know, not necessarily worshiping them if they're monsters, but just, like, knowing who they are, I could imagine that maybe the Chimera is a little bit smaller than it used to be in the past.
Or has changed its appearance to maybe try to scare a more modern sensibility. Like,
right. I love that.
With as often as characters, or as monsters, die, go to are sent back to Tartarus and reform in Tartarus, mm-hmm. I can feel like as they're reforming, they kind of morph themselves to whatever they think would be the scariest form of their particular.
I like that a lot. Yeah. That's cool.
Because, like, a more modern sensibility, our monsters in movies and things are way more realistic and way more terrifying than they used to be. I mean, think old Godzilla and old King Kong. Like,
yeah. Or even, like, Frankenstein. I think it was Frankenstein where people were literally passing out in the theater and stuff. Yeah. And, like, you watch that now and you're like, that's not really not scary.
No.
You know, our tastes and fears have changed. So you're right. It only makes sense that the monsters would adapt to that. I like that. That's a good headcanon. Okay, so the Chimera is also immensely strong and has human intelligence, which makes it scarier to me. Like, yeah. Having human intelligence, that is a smart cookie, so...
I mean, the other monsters we've met that seem to have human intelligence, like Camp,
mm-hmm.
are definitely scarier than, right. like, the Minotaur, who yeah. is huge and big and scary, but, like, doesn't have the smarts to outwit and outfight...
A 12-year-old boy.
Like, you know, it's mostly brute force and strength, yeah. and that's at least predictable, as mm-hmm. opposed to someone like Camp, who you don't know what she's going to do right. next. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this was a fun fact that I found very interesting. Most myths say the Chimera is female, and her name means she-goat. However, her head is that of a male lion, which I think has confused people over the years. So I'm curious if Rick, like, didn't realize that the Chimera was meant to be female, or just decided to change it to be a male creature or whatever, but I thought that was one of the interesting fun yeah, facts.
That is interesting.
And I also wanted to mention that chimeras are real things as well. We have, in botany, they are usually single organisms composed of two genetically different types of tissues. The word derived from the monster's name because of its several body part structure. And we've seen, like, cats, they call cats chimeras when they have the two, like, faces, like, one will be black and one will be orange or something like that. It's, like, split right down the middle. In paleontology, a chimera is a fossil which was reconstructed with elements coming from more than one single species of an animal, which makes sense. I hadn't thought of that before, but totally makes sense. There's also a type of fish related to sharks and rays called the chimera. It's weird looking. It doesn't look like it's, you know, pieced together or anything like that, but it is a weird looking fish, so... I thought all of that was very interesting.
Yeah, agreed.
This was cool for me because, like I said before, we weren't super familiar with Echidna, the Chimera a little more so, and I really like how the Chimera has been used in Teen Wolf. Basically, the Chimeras were a group of kids who were spliced with other monsters, so they were like, instead of a werewolf, it was like, what was the one? The one was, what's that thing called? Wasn't one like a lamprey?
Yes.
Yeah, one was like a lamprey and a kid, and then you had a few other ones.
Why am I drawing a blank?
And now I kind of want to look this
I can
up.
See the episode. Like, I can see moments from the storyline, but what is my brain... Because they were created by the Dread Doctors, right? They, like, spliced human...
Yes.
Human... kids with these other sorts of DNA and things to give them, like, abilities and qualities that have to do with the other portion of their DNA. So, yes, I remember the Lamprey kid, because that was weird.
Not that we need to get into this, but I was looking through this, and in the Wikipedia, they mention that Belasco, who had, like, the claws that he could, like, suck powers from, was one of them. Theo being a were-coyote. Oh, Kanema, technically, but that was Tracy. One was part scorpion, which was kind of interesting. The Wendigo, technically, I guess, was... That was part of the Dread Doctors season. So, there were just quite a few. I feel like there was one in particular. Oh, invisibility was one of the things.
Which would kind of be, like, camouflage, so they could have used, yeah. like, a chameleon or something like that.
Yeah. So, anyway...
Yeah, I like that some of these lesser known and slightly different Greek monsters, maybe not using the monster itself, but kind of using the myth or the qualities of it, it's kind of being utilized in modern storytelling. Like, mm-hmm. taking the idea of the Chimera and saying, okay, well, in our story, more you can be a Chimera if you have more than one type of DNA in your body. We're right. going to use that as the definition. And so then you've got all these different chimeras, and I think that's a really cool, like, quality. I like when they can kind of take something from Greek mythology and say, like, this is a really cool concept that we can kind of move forward, again, into a modern storytelling medium and say, hey, we can try all of this, and it makes for fun new things.
Yeah. Okay, so that is it for our discussion today, and now we're moving on to The Last Olympian.
Yes, and we read chapter 6 for today, entitled My Cookies Get Scorched.
Which could have been a funny, like, double entendre kind of thing, but wasn't. It was literally cookies getting scorched.
That's exactly right, yep. Shadow travel is not for the weak, let me tell you. But anyways, they arrive at a cliff in Connecticut, right across the street from the Castellan house. Mrs. O'Leary lays down for a nap as Percy and Nico go visit Luke's mom. She is dotty and kind of all over the place, mistaking both of them for Luke and trying to feed them all Luke's favorite things. The house is covered in layers of peanut butter sandwiches, chocolate chip cookies, and Kool-Aid. All of Luke's favorite things. Nico finally asks May the questions he needs answered. She tells them of the time not too long ago that Luke returned home to ask for her blessing to do something. She wholeheartedly gave it, hoping he wouldn't stay away again. Worth noting, his eyes were blue at the time. After they learn these facts, May's eyes glow green, and she seems to know something about Luke's fate in all this. It's super creepy, and Percy and Nico hightail it out of there. When they return to their cliffside landing spot, they see a fire is burning away with Mrs. O'Leary nearby. The girl tending the fire is Hestia, goddess of the hearth. She tells Percy that she is the last Olympian, and he will have to remember her when he makes his final decision. Nico then hints at his plan a bit more, but I have a hunch we're going to see his plan in action soon. Hestia is grateful to Percy for making a sacrifice to her before chowing down on the feast she provided, so she sends them to his home hearth, his mother's apartment. Mrs. O'Leary doesn't really fit and breaks all of the living room furniture, but Percy gets his mother's blessing to enact Nico's plan. Her only request is a blue signal that he's alive if he survives this upcoming ordeal. They agree on a blue signal on the Empire State Building as the sign. It's time to go, so Percy asks Mrs. O'Leary if she's ready for more shadow travel. Nico hints that this is going to be a shorter journey than Percy thought. There's an entrance to the underworld a lot closer than LA. Okay, so, yeah, this chapter starts with them finishing their shadow travel, and Percy kind of describes it as being not for the weak because it challenges your stomach and if you're afraid of the dark, like, it's not a great way to travel. And I can only imagine that it was basically, like, pitch black and he's just, like, hurtling through darkness.
Yeah.
And that would be terrifying.
It would be.
I kind of love that we get a brief moment to think about shadow travel because it sounds cool and, like, we don't really get it broken down. Like, Nico doesn't really explain exactly what it feels like or how it's happening, but he tells you, like, you're traveling through the shadows, so it makes sense that it would be a little creepy. Anyway, so they arrive on, like, a cliffside right across the street from May Castellan's house, and I love that Mrs. O'Leary, like, immediately just, like, flops and needs a nap. Yeah. Like, it's really cute, and I love Percy's line there when he's like, Nico, are you gonna take a nap too? Like, and Nico's like, no, I can shake it off. I just get a little drowsy, but it'll be fine. Like, I just love how it's like, yeah, do you need a nap? Yeah. So, walking up toward the Castellan house, the outside appearance of this house gives you the hint that something is interesting going on with her or with the house. Because as they're walking up the walk, there's basically, like, beanie babies.
It's so funny that you said that because, like, they're described as, like, beanbag, like, toy animals, yeah, basically. And it never occurred to me that they were basically beanie babies. Maybe he just couldn't, like, say beanie
babies.
Yeah,
no, I'm sure he couldn't, yeah.
But now that I can picture them so much better now.
Yeah.
And now they need to obviously come out with a line of beanbag Percy Jackson-related little monsters.
Yeah. No, totally buying the dragon or the, like, minotaur.
The minotaur.
Or the chimera.
I don't know, like, why I love the minotaur so much, because it's not a good dude, but, like, he's just so iconic.
Agreed. But yeah, so there are these little monster beanie babies lining the walk, and they've been there for a while. They're, like, kind of grody, and I think he says that, like, there's a weed growing from between,
yeah,
the Hydra's neck.
A sapling, so, like,
yeah,
it's a tree.
It's a whole tree.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, you kind of get the impression that something's not quite right with this woman, because who leaves Beanie Babies outlining their sidewalk for years and years and years? And then when they get onto the porch, there's like a ton of wind chimes. It's not just like, oh, a nice wind chime or two. It's like a ton of them, and it's everywhere. And so it just leads you to believe that May Night might not be right, which, when you open the door and walk in, is evident very quickly. Well, she immediately greets Nico as if he was Luke and just like is all up, you know, in his face, like, Luke, you came home, I'm so glad. And then she like switches, looks at Percy and says the exact same thing, like, oh my god, I'm so glad you're home. And so you're like, okay, clearly, you know, Luke leaving had something to do with this. But as they talk, we also learn that something happened to her that Hermes warned her against doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something like magical that stressed her brain too much. And that's why she's kind of trapped how she is now.
Yeah. This is the part that I found most intriguing, because when Percy describes what she looks like, he kind of describes her as looking like she stuck her finger in a light, you know, an electrical outlet. Her hair's all frizzy and stuff. And he also says she has high voltage light coming from her eyes. And he says that he's pretty sure she's blind. So she can obviously, like, see something, because she can look at Percy and think that he's Luke. But the idea that her eyes are, like, glowing, I think that's what he meant by that. Like, high voltage light coming from her eyes. And we learn that she could see through the mist very well, and that the gods offered her a job, which clearly seems to imply being the Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
But that she went too far and has kind of gone crazy.
Yeah.
As a result.
Like, I can only imagine, and I don't remember if we get into more of how her story unfolds. I feel like we do get slightly more to...
Maybe once we can relate it to Rachel, we can understand May a little better.
That's what I'm thinking, but I can just imagine, like, if she's working as an oracle, if, like, that worked or whatever, and she gets some sort of prophecy that shows something going wrong with Luke, that mm-hmm. she just starts diving and, like, trying to figure it out, and again, just goes too far and can't come back.
Yeah.
And I could see it being a possibility.
So here's a question for you. The oracle we see in the attic is obviously very old, because it's just bones at this point. May would have gotten the job as an oracle after that person was done or whatever. And then it must have reverted back to the previous oracle when she didn't work out. Or can there be one? I don't think there can be more than one oracle.
I don't think so either. My guess is that that oracle was, like, formally saying, like, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
And they passed it to May. Like, they asked her to take on the mantle because of her abilities, and she said yes. And then maybe, like, when she went too far, when her brain was addled, either it automatically did, or the gods forced this oracle right. to take the power back.
Yeah.
Even though she was already dead or close to it.
Right.
Because of the, you know, powers of the gods, they kind of forced
it. Maybe that's what happened. Like, that oracle died or something. Then it went to May, and then it reverted back when she couldn't handle it. So they'd rather have a dead body than May.
I mean, I can kind of see it.
Yeah.
With what happens in the next few minutes. But yeah. So that it's, yeah. I hope we get something more, even if it's just a few little details here or there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would like to know, like, actually what happened to May.
And it's interesting because she still has visions. Her eyes still glow green. So technically she still has this power in some capacity, but it's very broken.
Yeah.
So maybe it just doesn't count if there can only be one.
I mean, or she may not be an oracle anymore, but because she spent time in that mind space, she has access to it and just gets broken pieces. So it's not actually foretelling anything. She can't foretell anything, but she can see images because she's been there before, would be my guess. Something like
that. That would make sense, I think.
Okay, so yeah, she has been basically stuck doing what she was doing when Luke left the last time. And she's been preparing for his return this whole time, which is why there are moldy peanut butter sandwiches and burnt cookies galore all over her house. Nico kind of locks Percy back in and says, hey, we're here for a purpose. Like, I know this doesn't look great, but we have to talk to her about something. So Nico asks her about Luke and says, like, has he ever returned since, you know, has he ever been back before now, basically, mm-hmm. since she thinks they're Luke. And she kind of gets very clear as she starts talking about this and says, yes, he returned. He asked for my blessing. I wholeheartedly gave it to him. Like, she's hoping that this is, you know, giving him her blessing is going to be the reason he stays instead of leaving again.
Right.
Which obviously we know didn't happen. And then Nico makes a point to ask her what color Luke's eyes were when he came and made this request. He says, were they gold? And she says, no, Luke has blue eyes. They were blue.
Mm-hmm.
So we now know that in order to do whatever Luke did, he stopped to start the whole process by asking for her blessing, and it was before he was embodying Kronos. So this was all right. Preparation of his body, which we knew something happened to prepare him because he could host Kronos where most humans could not.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so then, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, May's eyes glow, like, green, and suddenly she starts freaking out, and at those moments, it's like she knows Luke's fate. It gives you a bit of, like, because she's screaming, like, not my Luke, not that, like, all kinds of weird, just uh-huh. freaky things, and it makes you feel that much, you know, more, it's that much more of a direct line to maybe she was the Oracle, right. or maybe she was doing works very similar to the Oracle at some point.
And I think it's important to point out here, too, that Percy sees the photo that Rachel drew on, like, the mantle or something like that, so...
And he says, like, how did she see this? Yeah. Like, how, you know, nobody's seen this. Nobody's been in here besides Nico. Like, how did she know?
Come on, Percy, put two and two together.
You're a smart kid. You can do it.
Before we move on to the next part, I also wanted to mention that Hermes also visits May sometimes.
Yes.
Which I found to be very interesting. And I'm very certain that this is brought up again, and there's, like, a little bit of an explanation kind of thing. So I just wanted to mention it here so that we could talk about it again later down the line, closer to the end of the book.
No, sounds good. Yeah. You kind of get the impression that Hermes isn't... that he visits... We don't really get an answer for why he visits, but I do kind of... You know, it makes you feel a little better that he visits. Hermes isn't the worst of the gods, so it kind of makes you like, oh, he visits, like... That's good. But anyway, we'll get to that. So yes, they hightail it out of there because she freaks them both out, which I totally get. And so they run back to their spot on the cliff. And as they arrive, they see Mrs. O'Leary napping next to a campfire, which is being tended by Hestia, who is not fighting Typhon like all of the others. And they kind of ask her why she's not. And she says, I'm the one who tends the fires the others leave behind. She's like, I'm not a fighter. It's not what I do. I tend the fire and welcome people home. So while everyone else can go fight, there's literally nothing for me to fight with or to do. So I'm going to stay here. And that's about when she volunteers that she is the last Olympian. She is the last one. She's the one who stays home. The last one that will reign because the others are all fighting. So clearly, if, you know, if there's only one left, it would be her. And so that is going to be important sometime in the future.
Yeah.
Because she makes a point to talk to Percy about him remembering her when he's making his final decision, remembering her qualities and what makes her important to the gods and the pantheon of gods. But then she also starts talking about the power of yielding and how it's the hardest power to master. And she only does this after she makes the fire, like, flare up and get huge. It's like she's showing Percy what power is. And, like, look, I have power. Like, makes this inferno. And then immediately brings the fire back to what it was and tends the hearth and keeps it, you know, a well-stoked, well-burning fire. So I couldn't help but look at it and be like, this, it's a really, really great bit of not necessarily foreshadowing, but, like, leading the reader to look at what's happening on the page as opposed to telling you
right.
what you should know.
Yeah.
Like, thinking about the idea of power and the idea of having power but not using it and what that means and all of that. And I just, mm-hmm. it made me a little tingly because it's like, that's the cool stuff when an author can kind of give you these moments. Mm-hmm. And I just felt really amped up.
I really, really loved this scene with Hestia. I think everything from start to finish was so interesting, and I was reading everything so closely because it does feel like a bit of foreshadowing. It feels like a lesson that Percy doesn't quite grasp yet, but like he soon will, kind of thing. And even from like the way she's described, she's described as an 8-year-old girl with mousy brown hair, a simple brown dress, a scarf over her head, and red eyes, which the red eyes are a little bit creepy. And the fire in her eyes are warm and soft compared to, like, Ares's angry fire eyes.
If you think of, like, embers as opposed to flames.
Yeah.
So it's that warm red glow of a fire as opposed to the flaming, scary redness of the actual flames.
And the fact that she shows up as a little girl who has mousy brown hair, that's usually, you know, how you describe somebody who looks very plain and, you know, that sort of thing. A simple brown dress, like a scarf over her head. She's not trying to show off her power. She just exists, and this is the form that she's most comfortable in. Percy also, he recognizes her in this moment. He goes, "The first time I came to camp, you were sitting by the fire in the middle of the commons area, and I went back and looked in Lightning Thief." And on page 80, at least in the hardcover copy, I don't know if the pages change that much copy to copy, but it says, "In the center of the field was a huge stone-lined fire pit. Even though it was a warm afternoon, the hearth smoldered. A girl about 9 years old was tending the flames, poking the coals with a stick."
What chapter is that in?
That is chapter...
Just in case people want to actually go back and see the moment.
It's chapter 6, I Become Supreme Lord of the Bathroom.
Okay, so if you're looking for it, that's
And it's when Chiron is taking him around to look at the cabins and the stuff like that. So I found that to be very interesting. I don't know if this was the plan literally from the beginning to tie these two together, but just the idea that, like, a goddess was at camp stoking the fire is very interesting. And of course, now we know how important that campfire is and how fire at camp is in general, because they make sacrifices to it with the food, and the flames we know now represent the feelings of all of the campers, so that's all super interesting. Hestia also makes sure to mention that Percy did not come up to her that first day, didn't go to greet her, and says that most campers don't. They're too busy in their own heads doing their own thing. But Nico was one of the only demigods in a very long time to ever talk to her. And, like, if you didn't already love Nico so much, he's the type of person who will find the person who looks lonely and go up to them to make sure nobody is left behind, like we heard about Bob. And I just, like, even as a 10-year-old kid, he was this type of person, and I find that so beautiful.
He is the champion of the overlooked.
Yeah.
He's the one who's always looking for that person who people don't notice and that people, you know, shove aside and don't care about. Those are the people that Nico's like, I'm gonna come hang. Like, let's see what's going on.
I love that so much.
Yeah, it's one of his most redeeming and wonderful qualities.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to mention about Hestia was she and Percy are talking, and they basically bring up the story of how she gave up her throne to Dionysus in order to prevent a civil war. And this is where she teaches Percy the value of yielding and that her job is to tend the fire at Mount Olympus. And it's so interesting because you can feel that, like, she's not bitter, but she also hasn't forgotten what she's had to sacrifice in order to keep the peace. And at the same time, like, I think above anybody else, even above Athena, who is obviously the goddess of wisdom, Hestia sees the bigger picture and is willing to sacrifice and suffer in order to make sure that everybody else is happy. And I kind of love that about her. I think that it makes her a different kind of god. Even Athena, who can see the bigger picture, sometimes does things out of anger and emotion, even if she doesn't want to admit it. But Hestia, I feel like she just really sees this bigger picture.
Part of that for me is literally in... She is the goddess of the hearth, and in many cases, especially before these days where we don't really use our fireplaces as they used to, the hearth was the center of the home because it was the heat source. It was where you ate food. It was, you know, it was everything. If it wasn't for the fire and the hearth, like, you wouldn't survive. You'd die. And so I kind of see her and her job as being the tender of the fire and keeping the home hearth burning and alive. She's kind of more so than Hera, the mother of the Olympians.
I was just thinking that. She's a family, too.
And mothers more often, you know, are the ones making sacrifices for their children, for the family, for, you know, in literature especially, that's become the case. And so it just... It really drives home that while there are other Olympians who take the title of mother or take the title of greatest or whatever, she is the one who keeps things together. She's the one making sure that Dionysus gets a seat, takes her seat, which puts the power off balance as far as, like, female gods versus male gods. But, like, in the grand scheme of things... People are going to be better. It's going to be better than it was. It's going to stop this war or keep the gods from going to war against each other. Like, she takes that on as her job. And
she very specifically says it's not a perfect solution, but it was the only solution that would stop this civil war from happening. And I kind of like that she recognizes that, too.
Yeah. So basically, Hestia is awesome.
Yeah. We're fans.
And I'm interested to see how she ties back into the story, because clearly she's going to play a role later on as
The book is named after her, so...
Right. It's the last Olympian. She is the last Olympian. All of this foreshadowing to remember me and all of that. She's clearly coming back. So we will see Hestia again. I can promise you that. Okay, so she does tell Percy that because he offers a bit of his feast, she's provided this massive feast full of all the things you would cook at home, which, again, just another thing. Tying her to that role. Percy offers her a bit just like they would at camp, and she says, like, I get the first bite of this. Like, when you guys offer offerings, I get a portion of all of them because of my job. So she offers to return him to his home hearth, which means poof, they are back in Sally's apartment in New York.
Yeah. And Percy very specifically refers to them to Sally and Paul as his parents.
Yeah.
As his parents. And, like,
aww.
I love heartwarming stories where, like, the stepdad or stepmom is, like, part of the family, that the kids have good relationships with them. And, like, we are obviously fans of Paul. If you didn't already know that, you will know by the time we get to our favorite moments, because we're big fans.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so, yes, they arrive, and Mrs. O'Leary is a very tight fit. she destroys all of the living room furniture, and Percy, you know, apologizes profusely. But Paul is thrilled to pieces to see this giant hellhound in his house. Most humans would be terrified. And, or upset at all of the breakage and things. And Paul acknowledges, like, yeah, that's not great. But I can see her. She's clearly magical. And that means I can see every, you know, like, it's him getting a taste of Percy's world. Yeah. He's been told about it. He knows about it, like, intellectually. But I think this is the first time he gets to see what that actually kind of means.
Yeah. And I love this because... Percy told Paul about a year ago about him, about monsters, about the Greek gods, and Sally backed him up, and Paul chose to believe them without any real evidence. Later, recently, so a year later, he's seen the horse hooves on top of the car.
Yes.
And he was like, okay, like, that's weird, but he still hadn't seen concrete evidence. But just the fact that he believed them and supported them and married Sally and on top of all of that just goes to show you what a good dude Paul is. And, yeah, him being excited over Mrs. O'Leary was... was really great.
Right? It just, he's so excited.
Yeah.
And it's just, I can just see it. Is it sad that because his name's Paul, It's just the name thing. My brain pictures, like, Paul Rudd sitting in her apartment, like, smiling at this
giant... He would be so good at that.
...furry hellhound. Like, ugh, it would be so adorable. He could be a good Paul Blofus.
Yeah.
We've got a few seasons. They can talk to him.
Yeah.
Paul Rudd's up for anything. So... Percy and Nico, while they didn't necessarily choose to go there, it was their next step on the journey, because now that they've done this, we learn that Nico wants Percy to follow in Luke's footsteps and to go about this same process that got Luke ready for Kronos, to give Percy the power to fight Luke fairly, as opposed to being human and being sliced with the scythe once, or touched with the scythe barely once, and having it be debilitating, like we saw on The Princess Andromeda at the beginning of the book. So, Percy and Nico are there to get Sally's blessing, the same way Luke needed May's blessing. And Sally hesitates.
Thank God.
As any good parent would.
Because she's been a little too supportive, in my opinion, in the past. And I realize that she just knows that this is Percy's life and that she can't change it. And I love that for her. I love their relationship. But I really appreciated that she hesitated here and was like, this is super dangerous. Are you sure you have to do this? Like, what kind of risk are you willing to take? And like, I know she gets it, but just the fact that she's afraid just... meant it gave just a little more realism to that relationship.
Well, and I mean, we still technically don't know what Nico's planning. We kind of know because we've read this book before, but we don't technically know because he hasn't told us yet. But she seems to be hinting that this process that Percy is about to undergo is as dangerous as all the other crap that's coming his way.
Mm-hmm.
He could be killed by Typhon. He could be killed by any of the monsters coming out of Tartarus, or Kronos, or Luke, or Lucronos, or whatever. But this process that Nico wants Percy to undergo could also kill him. And so Sally's like, what's the point in all of this other stuff happening if you're gonna die before it ever gets here? Like, you know, she's a little panicked. But it makes... you know, it makes very good sense that she's at least giving Percy a moment to think long and hard about the decision he's making here. It's not something to be taken lightly, and her giving her blessing is a big thing because she's basically giving him a blessing to sacrifice himself.
I was going to say, that puts her into an active role in what is going to happen next, and that's got to be hard to have on her shoulders. She's not used to that sort of thing.
Yeah, like, she's taking on a bit of the responsibility here. If something happens to him, she's going to think, if I didn't give him my blessing, he would still be here. He wouldn't have died doing this or whatever. So, it is a lot to put on Sally, but it's necessary. It's a part of the whole process. So she gives her support after the hesitation and really talking to Percy about it. She does tell him that he has her blessing. And before they leave, because as soon as they get her blessing, it's time to go, because we all know time is of the essence at this point. Sally reaches, you know, looks at Percy and says, I want a sign. When this is all said and done, I know you're going to be busy. I know you're going to be running all over the place, but I need a sign that you survived. I need to know for a fact, something that can't be mistaken. I need to know that my child survived all of this. And so Percy and her agree that if this all works out, that the Empire State Building is going to light up blue.
Do they specifically say, like, the building will light up blue, or it's just, like,
it's something... It's a signal from the Empire State Building...
That's blue.
That's blue.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was just going to be, like, a tower of light or something like that, but...
I mean, I don't think they're specific, but the logical thought is that the Empire State Building's going to light up.
I know, blue. And then we just had that.
It does in our world, and it makes it so cool.
I love that.
It's good fun, yes. So, with that, with her blessing and all of that, they get ready to leave again, and it's time to shadow travel again, but it's not going to be as far as Percy thought, all the way to LA. There's another gate to the underworld, and it's apparently very close by.
Poor Mrs. O'Leary did not want to shadow travel again.
She's not ready. She's like, no, I'm just finally waking up. Like, rude. Oh, Mrs. O'Leary. But that pretty much wraps up this chapter.
Yeah.
Lot of stuff. Couple of stories getting pushed forward, and I think we're probably on our way to figuring out Nico's plan.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the next chapter is going to be Nico's plan, so we'll get a good picture of all the details there. All right, so let's do our favorite moments and our favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to go first with your quote?
Yeah, mine is from Hestia, just because I thought this was a really beautiful quote. She says, "I'm here because when all else fails, when all the other mighty gods have gone off to war, I am all that's left. Home, hearth, I am the last Olympian." And, like, there were a lot of really funny moments in this book, especially with Mrs. O'Leary and Paul Blofus. But, like, this just really grabbed me. I thought it was so epic in its idea. And, of course, it will play a bigger part later on. So I really wanted to highlight it.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad you picked that, because as much as, like, we all love the like, sassy, fun, silly moments, Rick does those moments really well, and it's so well written, the way she says it, and it really hit home when she says, like, "I am the last Olympian."
Yeah.
You're like, wait, that's the title of the book and we're getting it now.
Yeah.
We're in chapter 6.
Yeah.
Like, nothing's happened, and we already know who the last Olympian is. Like, it kind of takes you off guard for a minute, so I'm really glad you picked her, because it's
an
important quote.
Yeah, I did not remember meeting Hestia this early in the book.
Me neither. Definitely not.
Or in book one.
Right? I know. Or in The Lightning Thief, where we actually met her and didn't know it. Okay, and mine is a little funnier. It's literally the opening quote from this chapter. And Percy says, "I don't recommend shadow travel if you're scared of the dark, cold shivers up your spine, strange noises, or going so fast you feel like your face is peeling off. In other words, I thought it was awesome."
I'm glad
you
liked it.
It's just so Percy.
Yeah.
To be like, it was super dark and creepy and strange, but I loved every second. I mean, it just, I don't know. Something about it, it just screams Percy. Okay, so now we do our favorite moments. Mine was Paul Blofus' reaction to Mrs. O'Leary and just his pure joy at seeing her in their house destroying all of their stuff. Like, it's so counterintuitive, because you just picture the parents being mad, or not even like mad, but like disappointed that all of their stuff is in a shambles, but like,
or even scared because there's a giant hellhound in your living room.
But no, he's just grinning from ear to ear and excited to see her and to like play with her and make her tail whap really hard against the floor and scare everyone in the building. Like, it's just, it's amazing. It makes me happy. What was yours?
Mine was Paul supporting Percy and saying that he's courageous. And he says this because he knows Sally needs to give her blessing to Percy. And I think that Paul, even though he's new to this world, I think he can glean how heavy this moment is. And not only it's important, but, like, it's risk. Like, the fact that Percy has to do this, that Sally doesn't want to, gives him enough information to go, okay, like, we should all be trying to think clearly and think whether or not this is the thing we want to risk. But him and Percy exchange a look, and in that moment, he kind of just gets it. And he turns to Sally, and he tells her, Percy needs this. He's being so courageous. I wish I was that courageous. And, like, gave me goosebumps. It made me want to cry. I loved it so much.
Right. He really is a bit of strength for her.
Yeah.
Like, he knows what she needs to do, and Sally knows what she needs to do. And she's hesitating because she loves him and is a good mother. And I just love that in that moment it kind of just coalesces into, like, the three of them are a family. And, like, Percy looking to Paul to help, and Sally needing Paul to help her make this statement and give Percy what he needs. And, it's just,
and Sally's beautiful. Not alone anymore. She doesn't have to worry by herself anymore. She has a husband who can be there to support her.
Yeah, it's really great. It's really great. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning into Rewatchable, which has covered series like Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy and Angel, and many more. Most recently, we've also discussed all four Matrix movies. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that features our biggest hypes and gripes in fandom and life, and we even post interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has previously discussed every episode of the show, conducted many interviews with the cast and crew, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Please find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms, and consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that is awesome. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for content and episodes you want to hear from us in any of these places. We love hearing from you guys, so please do. We do have a bit of feedback this week, an email, so I will let Karen take the email.
This is from Jubilee, which is just such a pretty name. I love it so much. Who writes in and says, "Hi, I love your show. It's so fun to listen to. You guys are hilarious." Thank you. "And I love the chapter by chapter segments. I don't know if you have already thought of this. If Percy had never gone on that trip with Sally in the first book, would the Minotaur have still found them somehow, or other monsters? When would Percy have gotten to camp? Would Sally have been taken?" I think this is actually really good. I don't think we talked about this at all, which is one of the, like, very first things in the book that you actually could do, like, a what-if spin-off scenario for.
Oh, yeah.
But
it could literally change everything, because the only reason Percy, like, survives it is because he's literally at camp's door.
Right.
So, like, if they didn't take that trip and weren't at the seaside and weren't nearby camp, what would have happened?
Right. I think another monster would have shown up, even if it wasn't the Minotaur, just because I think at that point, like, he was getting too close. Things were too crazy around Mount Olympus with the lightning thing being taken that somebody would have found him. Could have ended up much worse. I feel like you're right. This is like the best case scenario that it happened this way. Poor Sally.
Part of me wonders if this wasn't kind of driven this way. Like, I don't necessarily think Sally knew this was going to happen, but I wonder if her seeing through the mist, like, she got some inkling that he needed to be close to camp.
Mm.
Like, monsters have been coming after him. Grover and Chiron have been around him at that point. Like, you know, I wonder if she didn't have, not necessarily, like, made a decision to take Percy closer to camp, but if she just subconsciously, like, took him to the shore and got him closer there because she could almost feel something lurking or something coming. She's got this ability to see through the mist and to kind of have a bigger picture than most mortals, so I kind of wonder if maybe something didn't draw her there.
And she's been protecting him so long, I think that she would always be kind of on high alert.
Yeah, like that instinct to protect him kind of rules. Yeah. Definitely a good question, though. That's a good one. We also had two tweets. I will let Karen take the first one.
Okay. This was in response to when Rick's blog came out and he talked about the symbols on the flags on the cabins. I was like, oh, cool. Like, he mentioned that this is the language of the gods. Like, does anybody have any theories or headcanons or something like that? And I think we all pretty much just assumed that it was, like, you know, this language of the gods where, like, the ancient beings probably spoke it or wrote it or something. But Nephilee at Nephilee49618092 wrote in and said, "In the Iliad and Odyssey, it is mentioned that the gods have their own language of sorts. For example, mortals call the river at Troy Scamandrios, but the gods call him Xanthus, etc. So it would be so cool to see this reflected in the show as well." I did not know that. I tried Googling this and, like, I found where this is mentioned, where in the passage in the Iliad, like, it does literally say, like, man calls him Scamandrios, but the gods call him Xanthus, which presumes that the gods have different names and therefore a different language from mortals. But I couldn't, through my 10-second Google search, find much more on this. And there's got to be some, like, scholarly articles out there or something about that. And I want to know more. So if anybody knows more about this, even just a starting point that I could look into it, I would be so interested in that.
Just a link, whatever. Yeah. If you don't have time to explain it, that's fine. But if you know anything or know any resources to get into this, feel free to share them our way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also got a comment from Mac Aguirre at Mac2AGR, who says, "Deaf language of gods. Maybe we'll see a scene where the symbol becomes number 3 as the cabin number." That's a cool...
Yeah, this was interesting because on the Athena cabin, we thought we saw, like, a number 6, which would have made sense for, like, what cabin it was. And because that's Athena's cabin number.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, like, do the symbols change to numbers? Or, like, how does that, like...
Like, how they unscramble ancient Greek?
Yeah.
Does it kind of translate it and so they can see the three or whatever? Yeah, it could.
Who knows?
It's cool, though.
It is cool.
So we're not sure how that's all going to shake out, but thank you guys for reaching out about that. And thank you, Jubilee, for your email, because that was really cool, too.
Yeah.
All right, so next week... We are going to talk about some Percy Jackson board game ideas. We've got a few ideas of how we think this could be fun.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of fun talking about just, like, random things like video games and the theme park and, like, all that. So this is going to be one of those, I think, where we just kind of let our brains go crazy.
If you guys have ideas for original Percy Jackson board games, write in and let us know and we'll talk about it.
Heck yeah, that would be so cool.
Yeah.
Yep, yep, yep. But until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.